Hello, I'm Andrew Finney, and welcome to the Nurse Researcher Podcast, a podcast aimed at all nurses or health professionals interested in a research career. This podcast that will run fortnightly will feature nurse researchers from all levels, so PhD candidates, PhD students, postdocs and professors, and occasionally we'll throw in the odd bonus episode. We hope you enjoy it and find it really valuable. Do listen to the end where Eleanor and I do summarise the interviews, and if you get the chance, do click follow where you listen to your podcasts and you'll never miss an episode, and do give us a rating. Hello and welcome to the Nurse Researcher Podcast. And this week, as ever, I'm delighted to have our guest with us. And this week it is Professor Calvin Morley from Southbank University in London. Calvin, delighted to have you with us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon.
And you have a wonderful reputation and you've been on other podcasts. So I have heard things about you and I've listened to you on podcasts, and I'm delighted to have you with us because I want so many other people to hear your story. Your story just about nursing is fantastic. So your research journey, which is what we're here to discuss, is going to be equally fascinating to people. But I want to start you off with a little bit about nursing. How did you become a nurse? Why did you become a nurse?
I became a nurse because I needed to do something, like most people, and I had an option of either leaving the United Kingdom or staying. And one of my friends, so I fell into nursing. And one of my friends told me to apply. Fast forward, I applied. I didn't know what nursing was about, so I was rejected at the first stage. And the second hospital that interviewed me, so I'm going back then, I was a Project 2000 student. So that was the diploma in nursing student. And I fast forward, I took advice from one of the hospitals that interviewed me, because we were interviewed in the hospital still back then. And I went and got a job as a healthcare assistant. And I learned a lot about nursing. Mm. And I worked in an older people's care home. And it was the first time for me, it was a cultural shock to come across things like dementia and so forth. Because I didn't really see that where I grew up in Trinidad. So that's when my love started. I actually did, I didn't know what to do back then, but I did witness some abuse that happened in care homes. You know, so people would make fun of older people or move things, particularly for those who had dementia, so they'd be looking for it. And that was cruel. And I thought, well, I could kind of change that if I became a qualified nurse, because I'd have some sort of jurisdiction to then, you know, look at using what I now call evidence-based care to say how we should treat people.
Yeah. And did that lead to was your first career move as a nurse, was it into elderly care?
No, it wasn't actually. I enjoyed caring for older people as a student, but my first move wasn't into intensive care. As you know, when we're a student, we're exposed to, you know, all the different specialities. There are ones I utterly dislike. No offense to my orthopod colleagues, but orthopedics just wasn't my thing. But my final placement was in intensive care. And that's where I found my spot. When everybody in my cohort was saying, oh, I love A&E and I love cardiac. And I was like, I just don't know where I want to be yet. Mm. And that was my final placement. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. Yeah. So I qualified on an intensive care unit and then came to London and worked on one as well. So it was really wonderful.
It's funny, there's a lot of that, isn't there? It's that smooth transition, isn't it? You sort of, you've done your little bit of almost that preceptorship whilst you've been a student there, and you're ready to step into that new role. How did you, we always have to establish ourselves as a nurse, and we almost feel like, wrongly, that we have to do so many years before we can move into anything academic again. Or how did the move into any sort of the next piece of academic work or academic role come about for you?
So I worked at Guy's and St. Thomas's, and that, so I was at a stage where I became very disillusioned with nursing. It was politically at the time in the mid-1990s, and people weren't sure of where policy and health was going. And I became very disillusioned. And I thought, I'm going to leave nursing. I'm going to go back to university and do a different degree. And I went and I did a degree in politics. And I mean, your listeners can't see me smiling, but I am. I went and I did a degree in politics and I thought, I'm going to change the world. I'm going to be, you know, going to do something really different. And the more I studied politics, the more I realized how political healthcare, social care, welfare is. And so I went ahead and I got this degree. And when I came back, I was, you know, when I finished the degree, I never left the unit. My manager said to me, oh, you've got a degree in nursing. That's a very treasured qualification to have. What are we going to do with you now? And I just smiled and I was like, I don't know what she was thinking of. But at the same time, we had just recruited the first intake of Filipino and Indian nurses at the hospital. And they needed to do what we had called then the adaptation program. And I was the person responsible for that first cohort that came to us. So that's how I got into teaching and learning. Mm. So after I had a degree, my manager said, okay, you know, we're going to use you and your degree power, because the degree really taught me how to think differently as well and do those things. And then I moved on into teaching, and I saw this first cohort through, and a university was advertising, to answer your question, looking for someone to come and teach in elderly care. And I was like, I want to try this. I don't know if I'll get it. And I went, and I was appointed. Mm. And so I did go back to elderly care in some respects, and I taught on a degree program in caring for older people at what is now called the University of West London. And back then it was called Thames Valley University. And that's where I grew up academically as well.
Mm. So there was an element of full circle there, a little bit, wasn't there? Even though it was a small circle, it was early in your career.
Yeah.
And to be disillusioned by nursing, I wonder if that would have been even worse once you'd got to the politics side of it as well.
But I guess as an immigrant, I didn't always understand everything politically in this country. So I didn't grow up or work here during Thatcherism. So I didn't understand that. But during my time as a student of politics, at Goldsmiths College, University of London, we had Tony Blair came into power. We had the Berlin Wall came down, and America also changed their government. Clinton came into power. So I saw, you know, three sets of really large political things taking place as such events. So I really enjoyed that. And to be disillusioned, yeah, Chris, I wasn't sure nursing was the path that was for me. But in the end, I realized studying outside of nursing showed me what I didn't know about nursing and healthcare politically. And, you know, I guess what we call systems these days and how they operate. So that really helped me to understand and think wider.
Yeah. So you probably had more to offer for that second degree.
Yeah. I was also considered a mature student.
Yeah. I never know if that's a politically correct term or not. I never dare to use it, Kelvin, if I'm honest.
I was called for an interview. Because I had a diploma in nursing, so I'd surpassed the entry requirement. It's not like I didn't have the entry requirement, because most people were going on A-levels.
Mm.
And they called me for an interview, and they said, you'll be studying with much younger people. How would you cope as a mature student? That's what they wanted to discuss.
And yeah, well, we all get there, don't we, where we suddenly, but perhaps we should call it experienced. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's got to be a different way. So was that the clear then option for you to be? You're in education, you're in nursing academic in education. It's not an easy step, because we're in nurse education, we become educators. It's difficult to get on the career ladder from a research perspective. So how did you make that jump?
Well, there's two things. First of all, I love nursing and I love clinical nursing practice. I absolutely love. I just had a meeting with someone I've mentored for the Council of Deans, and I told him I've always enjoyed, particularly as an intensive care nurse, looking after one patient, no matter how ill they are. Mm. But that's who I'm responsible for that day. So I love clinical practice. And when I became a lecturer educator, I still maintain clinical practice, and to this day, I still practice. And it's only when I went for a job, someone asked me, well, you know, how do you maintain your clinical practice? And I sat there and I thought, and I just said, well, different models exist, and this is the model that I use. And I explained to them, and the person was interviewing me, she nodded and she understood. And she said, well, the model I use is that I'm a professor of blah, blah, and the hospital pays for me one day a week, etc., with the university. And I said, well, that's not how it worked for me. But I maintained that. And through those, what we now have, I was really and truly what I wanted to do was clinical academic work, which is what we now have. Mm. And I really champion clinical academic work and the sort of stuff Professor Julie Sanders at Barts Health QMUL does. I think we really need that. So in some respects, I see myself as a pioneer doing that because I have a lot of experience from it. But the more I maintained my clinical skills, the more I was able to piece together the research elements that needed to go with it. So how do we create the evidence? How do we implement the evidence rather than just teach about it?
Yeah.
So that's what, I guess for me, because I have always stayed in touch with my clinical practice, it helped me to validate the research I wanted to do and the research that I did do.
Yeah. And your PhD, how did that come about?
Well, coming back to full circle, my PhD was in life after stroke among African Caribbean women. Mm. And at that time, it's mainly elderly people. So I already had that fitting. But my PhD was a little bit more than that. That's very much the layman terms if I'm telling someone, oh, I looked at life after stroke. But what I really looked at was the interplay between gender, culture, race, and society on women's health. Because when I did my degree in politics, I became very interested in women's rights, women's health, and that side of politics and welfare. So when I did my doctorate, again, it gave me that grounding to look at what is the interplay between society and being Black, being female, having an illness. How do we make those repertoires? How does society reinforces the repertoires we develop as a person, you know, with illness. Mm. That's what I was really interested in. That little psychological bit of, you know, meaning making. How do we make meaning of our identity? So that's what I was really focusing on.
And was that a PhD that where you chose the topic? So you sort of devised that from a proposal stage, or was that one that was being advertised and you went for that with your enthusiasm? Because there are different ways that you can do it. If you're fortunate enough to write your own PhD proposal, it's easy to live with. Sometimes you go and do a PhD that's actually off the shelf a little bit. Was it something that you devised?
Now, listen, to those who are listening, I want to be really honest, because this PhD stuff, when we embark on this journey, it's really difficult, and people really need to know the truth. So I am of what the whole PhD thing is about when we get into it. A scholarship was advertised. I went and I applied. I did a presentation of what I thought I wanted to do, which was women's health in prison.
Wow.
And take a very public health approach to that. And you know, I was successful. I got the fully funded scholarship, and then I got there, and they said to me like 6 weeks later, "But we have no prisons here, and your work needs to focus in this geographical area of London." Mm-hmm. And so I went away, and I thought of what it is. As I said, I really wanted to do that interplay thing. So then I looked at the area and saw what illnesses, diseases were prevalent, and that would. Because a PhD is a journey, as we all know, those of us who've embarked on it. And it's not something you're going to give up halfway. So it had to be something I was passionate about. And the bit that I was really passionate, not saying I'm not passionate about strokes, but the bit that really kept me going was that thing about women and their rights and race and gender and how society, you know, we fit into society or society makes us fit into them. So that's the bit really. So my PhD was, I had to go back and design it myself.
Yeah.
And it had to be within something that met their criteria, that fitted that geographical area.
Yeah.
And at the time, stroke was really high among that population.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure it continues to be so. And where did that work take you? Was that the work that started off the rest of the sort of the continued research career, or was that just the means to an end with a PhD? Was your postdoctoral work follow the same question and take it further?
So the postdoctoral work really started through the Mary Seacole Fellowship. So I had a Mary Seacole Award, and that was really where my postdoc started. So some of the things I uncovered, as I say, where race and everything else was concerned and gender was to do with stroke and African Caribbean women. So I applied to, the Royal College of Nursing, who managed then the Mary Seacole Awards, and I was successful. And so then I started to look at, you know, the carer's experience, because that wasn't something I was looking at in my doctorate, but it was something that always bothered me. One of those findings you find, but you had to just park it at the back because it wasn't your research question. So I wanted to really look at the experiences of the carers of people living with stroke. And, but again, although it was stroke, it was really about the positioning of African Caribbean women or African Caribbean people and in society. And what I had learned from that is sometimes as Black people, when we are portrayed or we're written about, and sometimes me as a Black scholar will also do that, is that we write from a place of injustice and a place of trauma. And what we really need to do is write about the place of love and the place of joy. So I was writing, when I did the Mary Seacol Award, I was really looking at the trauma of people having to care for someone with a stroke, etc. But what I kind of almost neglected, but had to come to the realization of, was that actually there was a joy and a love in these families to look after their next of kin or whoever it was they were caring for. But I guess it's because of how research has always focused us. We've always written about the negative. And I see this today, you know, with moving on from Black Lives Matter to all my work in race. Sometimes most of the papers I read or you would read, it always comes from a place of trauma rather than actually this happened as an act of love and it's joy. And let's share how we can throw a different light. Or we can, you know, then multiply that in society to give society the different lens. So that's kind of part of where I am and where I've been with the postdoc as such.
And is your work today still focused very much in that area? I don't mean particularly stroke, but perhaps some of the inequalities.
So my work still focuses really and truly on that interplay between gender, culture, and society. I have to admit, I've always been drawn to women's health and women's and that's purely, I've said to people, not purely, but it's because I have a mother and five sisters. So I've grown up with a lot of females around me. And so I understand and I've heard them talk and their experiences. So that's the reason why, in case anyone was wondering. But so my work still continues in that area. I'm really now on this journey where I want to make better for our patients. But in order to do that, we need to make sure our nurses are equipped and our midwives and our healthcare professionals. So now part of my work focuses on, I run the Elizabeth Anuonyu Fellowship, the Dame Elizabeth Anuonyu Fellowship for Inclusivity in Nursing. And so that's where my work is focused, is how we develop a workforce that's going to meet those sort of inclusive needs. And by being inclusive, sometimes we are excluding other people. So it's a term we're using a lot politically, but I think we have to recognize that inclusivity is about intersectionalities. So we need to look at the intersectionalities, which goes back then to my doctorate, you know, gender, culture, society, race.
And interview, our first ever podcast was Professor Gina Higginbottom, and some of her work obviously very much in the news at the moment. So it's, when I spoke to Gina, it felt like there was still so much to do, but she felt like that she'd really achieved in that area. Do you feel like that? Do you feel like you've been able to really make a difference, or do you feel like there's still so much to do?
I feel like there's still so much to do, because right now I am looking at how we develop a pool of Black and brown researchers in nursing and midwifery. Because that when I go to a nursing and midwifery conference, the faces that I see are presenting, there are no new faces. So we need to do something about developing Black and brown researchers. So that's some of the things I feel I still need to do more. And hopefully that work will take off rather sooner rather than later. But like Gina, I also think I have achieved a lot. But there's this thing of, you know, sometimes we don't like to be too big about ourselves. And I remember when I gave my inaugural lecture, the provost, she was reading out all my achievements. And I was like, I was literally cringing, because like, oh my God, I must sound like, you know, I've done everything to all these people who are listening. But sometimes we do underplay our achievements. So people like Gina Higginbottom, myself, Laura Sarant, and a number of other people, we have all been Mary Seacol scholars. We all did that Mary Seacol program, which was a program that invested in Black and ethnic minority nurses and midwives. And that's why I come back to the Elizabeth Anuonyu Fellowship. We need to invest in people. And we need to also look at how we develop the Black and brown researchers. Because if we did those then, and now we're where, you know, dare I use the word, renowned professors in the UK and globally, then there is a space where we can develop people to help them reach their full potential.
And it does feel a little bit like you recognize the value of the award that you got, and you're trying to do the same. You're trying to give back with, with this, with a different award, but again, trying, striving to achieve the same things. What pushed you towards professor? How did you get there? Was there a particular pathway to that, or was that something that you were striving for?
When I did the Mary Seacole Award way back in 2014, Professor Carol Baxter looked at me and said, "Why are you not a professor yet?" And that was the first person who's lit that sort of, you know, flicker of light that, well, why am I not? Why am I not thinking of it? And because I thought, and most people probably still think, again, to your listeners, we all think a professorship is a long, drawn-out process. You know, I was thinking I'd become a professor in my 60s, you know. And that's what, you know, I was probably looking at and not, you know, as such. But so my work towards professorship was when I sat and I actually looked at my body of work, this body of work that I've done all around gender, health, and really and truly, I started to look at it. And then, look, where is the social justice? You know, well, this is what I've been really fighting for and striving for people. So when I started to look at my body of work, and then, you know, you get those invitations to, when you are invited as such, rather than you apply or you submit, you know, when you're invited, you're like, okay, they must really want to hear me. So then that's when I started to look at it. It was never on my horizon or my trajectory to say, I'll become a professor one day. I mean, I was like, yeah, probably in my 60s, I'll be one of those people. Because also at the time, those were the people of the age group I was seeing professors as, you know, not realizing that, you know, there is a way of how you do it. And I think certainly in this country right now, I am the only male professor of nursing from the Caribbean.
Yeah.
So we need to look at how we change that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you present yourself as a role model, but yeah, because that's how you come across, but there's got to be the people that come up through the ranks of nursing to be able to tread the same path, hasn't there?
Yeah. I think what we need to do is look at how, once we thread that path, my thing is certainly not, oh, well, if I've done it, you should be able to do it. Mm. It's, listen, these are the mistakes that I made, or this is what I probably should have done differently. Mm. I'm sharing it with you so you can look at how you get on to doing it.
And that's a perfect segue into my next question, because I always ask if you could start the research journey again, would you do anything different?
Would I tell you what, the one thing I would do differently is not take on so many roles. Because I think in academia sometimes, or in nursing and midwifery, we feel we have to please a lot of people. So I'm not saying I'm a people pleaser, but what it is in academic work and research work, you don't want to be seen as just doing research and not the teaching and learning. Mm. So I really and truly put my hands up for a lot of things I probably shouldn't have done, which has also given me good experience. But I think, and now the frameworks are much better. We could have people on a research trajectory framework or a teaching and learning framework or a combined one as such. Mm. And I think that will work better. And if I had that when I had started off in academia, it would certainly gotten me on a different, you know, pathway, probably quicker to where I wanted to be.
Yeah. And what's your role day to day? So if we've got very junior nurses or nurses that are quite junior to the academic side of the job, what's a day in the life of Professor Calvin Morley? What is it that your role requires now? Because there's a lot of leadership, isn't there, once you get to the level that you're at?
Yeah. So. When you become a professor and in my case, and as my professorship, my chair is in diversity and social justice. And so I have the way I see myself operating is two things. I serve the passion, which is my research. And obviously with that, you have to generate an income for the organization you work for. But I also have to serve the organization and some of that sort of citizenship work. Mm-hmm. So for example, here at my organization, I am the chair for our race equality charter. Mm. I support our Athena Swan. So I'm one of the leads on that as well. So there are different roles I do within the university. So a typical day may be, today I have meetings that deal with university-wide stuff, and I will not even get to touch the research Calvin wants to do. Yeah. Because by the time I'm finished doing that and I have my emails, the answer and all of that. It becomes difficult. So, but then there'll be days when I say, oh, it's my research day. Mm. It's never really my full research day, to be honest, because there's always something that pops up. But then there are those days where you can really contribute to what you want to do. And the other thing that's really part of my day is I always meet people for mentoring, coaching. So I do coaching for the Council of Deans leadership program. I mentor for my own program here through the Anuanu Fellowship. I supervise PhD students. So I have a whole group of PhD students whose work is in social justice in my area. Yeah. So by the time I'm a typical day, we'll always be meetings, but also be good meetings. It'll be the ones where you can talk to students, explore with colleagues, and really develop the passion that you have. And I love those days.
Yeah. And what's your proudest moment in the I won't say in the nursing career, I'll say in the research career. Or what are you most proud of?
What am I most proud of? To be honest, I am really most proud of the Dame Elizabeth Anuanu Fellowship at the moment. Because as you said, I had a fellowship and I developed, and I'm looking at how we give back. And, it's also that I give back to my home country. So I'm from the Caribbean, Trinidad and Tobago, and I work closely with the University of the West Indies. So pre-COVID, we ran the first ever mental health conference in the Caribbean in Trinidad. And we acknowledge that mental health is an issue because there are also lots of different cultural beliefs. And that was just really so proud that I could have taken colleagues from here where I work to the Caribbean, and we did a joint international conference and really make mental health something, an everyday vernacular we can talk about.
Yeah.
That, it wasn't in the shadow. So that was one of my proudest moments, to be able to give back to my country as such.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds a great thing to have done, actually, and I'm sure very unique, and hopefully just the start, you think, with things like that it allows people to start to discuss it a bit more freely.
Yeah, it is, but I didn't get there with all of the things that I've done or achieved on my own. Professor Mark Radford has been a really great cornerstone and strength and an ally and a friend and a colleague. Because when I wanted to do things, I could say, Mark, look, blah, blah, blah. I'd say, I need £1 million. And he'd go like, yeah, you'll really get £1 million, Calvin. But, but we start off small and we do things. I guess what I'm trying to say, people like Mark, like Liz Fenton, Vanessa Sweeney over at UCLH, we have to have colleagues around us, because they also help us make that achievement. It's not my professorship and the research work I do, it's not insular. It's not just Calvin. It's all these other people that support it.
And it, research feels that way, doesn't it? It has to be a collective body of people. Yeah. You can be the PI or the CI, but actually it's the team that's around you, isn't it, that makes it a success. I normally say now, as my final question, I normally say, what advice would you give to junior researchers or nurses that want to push into research areas? But on the back of what you've said, as a trailblazer and yourself and somebody that's probably got that fear of people aren't able to do the same thing, what would you then say to, I won't say just, junior nurses, but nurses of a Black African Caribbean heritage, what would be your advice for them to try and step on the research ladder and develop the career in that way? If they're listening thinking, well, you've done it, but I don't know how I would do it.
I think you need to reach out and speak to people. And speak to those people who will listen and who will be supportive of you. I have had people on both sides. People who listen and weren't supportive. People who listen and stole your ideas and you could see them run with it. But I think you need to find that giant whose shoulder you're going to stand on and who's going to mentor you and give you that little bit of their time. But you need to speak to people about your dreams because they're going to be as I said, it's not you alone. It's other people that help you make your dreams a reality. And I've been privileged to have some really wonderful people. As I said, like Professor Carol Baxter, Janet File, Laura Sarand, Mark Radford, Liz Fenton, people who have really supported my work. So I'm really privileged in that sense. And that's what I would like to do for other people, So I have every week, I have 3 or 4 emails from, nurses or midwives wanting to do a doctorate or just wanting to know what that process is like. And I will always make the time to talk to them about it. And I may never hear from them again, but at least I make the time to tell them what it's all about. Yeah.
Me too. Because I could often, I think I could become a supervisor 3 or 4 times a week if I, if I was willing to. Not that you'd have the time. It would be more than a full-time job. But I think it's good advice. And everybody that's been on the podcast so far always is able to say, this person helped me and this person guided me. And if you can become enabling for the next generation, then I suppose that's the big achievement, isn't it? If you nurture people and help them through as well.
And also, you know, people shouldn't, just to say to people, they shouldn't be afraid to share their dreams. And from when I qualified with a doctorate as such or graduated, times have changed. As I said, we have clinical academic pathways. We have different frameworks for working in education. So I think people just need to talk to the right people, find them.
And it feels like now's the time, doesn't it? There's far more now focused on non-medical awards for research, you know, the recent research for patient benefit. I know the NIHR School for Primary Care Research has done a non-medical call. So there's a wider net, isn't there, now to try to get nurses involved in research. And we've got to try to make sure that we're competitive in those nets.
I agree.
Calvin, it's been brilliant to talk to you. I'm always sort of delighted to speak to people, but it's a lovely interview and lovely to hear your story. And I'll remind the listener that I will invite you to provide me with 3 links to what papers that you'd want to read from your own work, and I'll put them into the link to the podcast. So, Professor Calvin Morley, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here and to share.
Welcome back again to the Nurse Researcher podcast, and I'm joined again by Eleanor Hover. Delighted to have you with us, Eleanor. And probably if we talk about Professor Calvin Morley, somebody that you sort of signposted me to and somebody that you know much better than me. So how did you summarise this episode?
Thanks, Andrew. Yeah. So I know Calvin, Professor Calvin Morley, through the CNO's Shared Professional Decision Making Council. He's the chair of that group. But also Calvin's research interests are related to my own research, which is around developing an inclusive health and care research system. And Calvin focuses a lot of his work around social justice. I found his story really interesting, and he's had quite a varied career, having done a degree in politics as well at a time when he became disillusioned with nursing, which was quite interesting. I would have liked to have heard a bit more. A lot of nurses at some point in their career, depending on, you know, where they're working. Interesting to hear how he described witnessing the care in care homes when he was a support worker, and, you know, what he described as being abusive care to some dementia patients. And this motivated him then to change what he was observing through developing a career in nursing, which would give him more authority to ensure that the care was improved. And then he went on to discuss how he found a passion for nursing education and clinical academic work. But what I found really interesting was, you know, he described his PhD, which focused on life after stroke with African Caribbean women and the intersections around race and gender and culture and health, and that his PhD kind of designed itself. But when he was awarded the Mary Seacole Scholarship, looking at the experience of carers living with stroke, he said he wrote from a place of love instead of injustice and trauma. And again, I would have liked to have heard more about that. I know he's developing his work around social justice and the distribution of opportunities and privileges amongst the nursing workforce. Fits really neatly with his interest in politics as well, but also his efforts in anti-racism. You know, and Calvin does highlight the lack of representation and diversity in our scientific workforce. And, you know, he also highlighted some of the work that individuals like Professor Gina Higginbottom, who you've interviewed, and Professor Laura Sarant have created more space for. And then I think he only touched on it, but he does tell us, you know, that he's taken on a lot of roles and stretched himself so much that he's swamped by work, particularly around anti-racism, which I know can be very exhausting and demanding. And he is in demand. You know, he's highly sought after to work in that arena. But he did explain, you know, having key allies is really helpful if you're working in anti-racism and social justice. And he noted the support of Professor Mark Radford, who's the deputy CNO. And, you know, this work does have to become a collective responsibility. And I think overall, he gave some good tips as well about developing a clinical academic career around, you know, ensuring you reach out and put in the effort to connect with people. I think that's really important, you know, network and gather support from other colleagues who are clinical academics or academics, and just surround yourself with individuals that are willing to listen and enable your development. It's really key to developing a clinical academic career. But I'd love to hear more about his social justice work and his anti-racism work as well, because I know how dedicated he is to that.
I mean, having not met him before, I didn't know what to expect. And because you don't, when you've got that title professor, you always wonder whether you're gonna speak to somebody who's, you know, who's quite reserved or who's, you know, holds back a little bit. But he was very open, very easy to talk to, very down to earth. You know, it did make me laugh when because I resonate with the thought of when he was saying, you know, he just thought a professor was somebody when they became about 60. You know, that made me chuckle. You know, as I was listening back to the interview on a dog walk, I was just chuckling away, thinking, yeah, I suppose I viewed it that way. And but going back to listening back, sometimes me as the interviewer, sometimes when I listen back, I think to myself, do I ask this next? I can't remember what I asked next. And there's one point where he was talking about the sort of the female element to it. And I was sort of thinking as he was saying it, you know, why is it not about all Black African Caribbean people post-stroke? And then when he mentioned that, you know, the only brother with lots of sisters and a mother and that loving environment, you just, like you say, that I think he's giving back a little bit, isn't he? The people that have helped his life. You know, I don't know whether he's the youngest sibling or the oldest, but I wonder whether he was really looked after by those sisters and that mother and whether that's his sense of, you know, giving back a little bit. But there's lots of, you know, we talk about compassion in nursing, don't we? And that's what he is, isn't he? This compassion. He's very compassionate about this group of people and all the people that he researches, really. It seems to be more about them than the question per se. You know, it's about them, isn't it? And I love that. And I could have talked to him all day. And I told him that, you know, I knew he didn't have time to talk to me all day, but I could have just sat there listening, really. He talks so freely and openly and from a place that I'm very comfortable with. And I enjoyed the interview very much.
Yeah, I did as well. I think you're right. I think it really comes through how important it is to him that individuals are cared for, and perhaps those individuals that are more vulnerable, and all patients are potentially vulnerable, aren't they? But particularly those who are older, maybe have dementia or have had a stroke, and also have those intersections of race and gender as well. And, you know, I would love to hear more from him as well about his experiences and what influenced him to become a nurse, and looking back, as you described, you know, about his childhood and growing up with five sisters, how that influenced him. But I did find it particularly interesting where he comes from, this position of love. It kind of just put, I suppose, trying to put a positive spin on something that can be quite maybe challenging, challenging area to research as well. So maybe one day we can have him back to find out a bit more about that. But brilliant to hear about such a different...
And I think the mentorship element as well, that he gets great pleasure from that, doesn't he? It's clearly time consuming.
Yeah.
We all get asked, once you get into sort of that mid-career researcher role, people do start to ask you a little bit of any sort of wisdom that you've got around their area. And it is difficult because you have so much to do for your own employer, and you have your own PhD students, and you don't want to push people away. But I would encourage more people who are early or senior career or mid-career research to try to be mentors for people from external places, from a different walk of life, and have different research questions to you, because actually what you offer them is a fresh pair of eyes and a bit of a sort of external view into, you know, through a different window of their research. And I really like that he did that mentorship, and he is supporting junior staff. And like Gina Higginbottom from episode one, perhaps guiding people to carry on the work that they've started, you know, and make sure that it doesn't come to an end with their research, that there are more people focusing in this area. And in Calvin's case, I suppose, you know, you're one of those.
Yeah. And I think he also hit on one of the other challenges, I think, of being a clinical academic, is that when you become passionate about maybe more than one area, like, you know, he's passionate about nurse education as well as his research and his clinical work. and social justice and anti-racism. And then suddenly, you know, you can end up being pulled in so many different directions. It can be quite a challenge to manage all that, but it comes from a place of, you know, really loving what you do, and dedication, really. But yeah, fascinating interview to hear from Calvin.
And I'll end this little summary by you may know this, but for any listeners that we've got who are more interested in Calvin's story, I pushed Calvin as much into research as I could for the sake of what our podcast is, but equally because I'd watched a podcast with him on the NHS Futures platform. And I would guide people to look for that as well. And if I can find the link to that, I'll add that to our episode notes.
Brilliant. Sounds great.
So on that note, that probably is enough for this episode. So thanks, Eleanor.
Thank you very much.